Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
We're going to turn to China right now and a very important trip for Janet Yellen, her second in 9 months to China. It's going to be followed by a trip by the Secretary of State, Antony Blinken. And as we try to get a sense, following the readouts and some of the other information that we've seen, try to get a sense of what came of this trip, we want to connect with Craig Singleton. I've been looking forward to this conversation with us from the China Program at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, where he is Senior Director. Craig, it's great to see you. You can read the readout, you can read the news coverage, and get different perceptions. I want yours. Was this a productive trip for Janet Yellen? And if so, what did we get for it?
Yeah, no, thanks, Joe. I mean, I think the short answer is that Secretary Yellen's trip accomplished very little. Secretary Yellen is many things, chief among them, an accomplished, I think, respected economist, but she's not an enforcer. You know, she's not the person you send in when you want to throw down the hammer, so to speak. And Chinese leaders more or less dismissed out of hand all of her concerns, which doesn't particularly bode well, I think, for next steps. I think from my perspective, at least, her trip sort of extends this illusion of constructive engagement between the two superpowers, but without actually addressing the core issues that are sort of fueling today's tensions. And, you know, separately for its part, at least, you know, China was very keen to capitalize on this trip for propaganda purposes, using Secretary Yellen's visit to project calm to investors who are very concerned about China's overall economic health and China's meager growth prospects.
So there are a lot of audiences here. When it comes to the audience in Beijing, Craig, what does it mean for an American official to pay a visit and ask you to rethink the way you're managing your economy? In this case, boosting its manufacturing capacity, saying, hey, you guys really ought to worry about increasing domestic demand because that's not working as well for us. What's the reaction?
No, I mean, I think it's been pretty clear for some time now that China's leadership has very little to maybe no interest in enacting major structural reforms to address the country's current economic challenges. So what we're seeing, right, is a sort of a back to the future approach in which China floods international markets with cheap, heavily subsidized goods to stimulate growth. And one major concern, for example, centers around electric vehicles. You know, China is intent on dominating this emerging sector. They see it as critical to leading the next industrial revolution. And with China's EV market already very heavily saturated, you know, China's thinking about dumping EVs on global markets, including here in the United States, which would have a pretty serious impact on U.S. automotive manufacturers, U.S. laborers here. And so while countries like Brazil and Argentina are getting ahead of Chinese dumping and raising tariffs to protect their industries, the Biden administration has yet to do that. And I think that's really a major mistake and a real missed opportunity here.
Well, so what does that mean for tariffs going forward? If we're dumping EVs or solar panels, whatever it is, Craig, this administration actually has not had a lot of sunlight between itself and the Trump administration when it comes to tariffs, although Donald Trump is talking about much higher levels if he were to be reelected. How about for the Biden White House?
Sure. I mean, I think what we're seeing right now is a reflection not of U.S. policy on China, but global pushback to China. You're seeing talk about raising tariffs and protective measures across Latin America, across Europe, and that's mostly in response to Chinese behavior. I think what the corollary to me is when the Obama-Biden administration was really trying to tackle Chinese hacking and cyber attacks against the United States, the Chinese out of the gate admitted those are activities they don't engage in, just like today they acknowledge and say that we don't engage in dumping and high, you know, non-market practices. And a great deal of time is spent negotiating a deal like that cyber deal. And then what do the Chinese do? They go about and actually increase the number of cyber attacks against the United States with absolutely no punishment from Washington. So I think China's perspective is let's buy some time here, get ourselves out of this economic chaos and crisis that we've created for ourselves, and do so at the expense of American workers and American companies and increasingly worldwide competition as well.
Spending time with Craig Singleton here on Balance of Power. What do you make of the proximity of this visit And Joe Biden's meeting with President Xi, I guess that was about a week ago at this point, Craig, were those companion conversations, if you will? Did that meeting with the presidents need to come first?
Yeah, I mean, they had a call, you know, President Biden and Xi Jinping had a call last Monday. I think there's a strong effort to sort of portray the bilateral relationship as stable or improving, but I think it's sort of a fallacy here. You know, since Xi and Biden met in San Francisco last fall, the U.S. intelligence community has confirmed that the Chinese are actively meddling and interfering in our election. Chinese state-directed hackers have been identified as not just accessing, but seeking to compromise our critical infrastructure, like our ports and electrical grids. Chinese Coast Guard vessels are ramming Philippine ships in the South China Sea, knowing full well that the Philippines and the U.S. are defense allies. Those are hardly, I think, reassuring. I think for me, at least, you know, the principal paradox of the Biden administration's China policy lies in its unintended consequences, right? So far from mitigating Beijing's brashness, a lot of these deep recent diplomatic overtures have emboldened Xi. And I think with Washington's attention diverted to Ukraine and Israel and to a number of pressing domestic matters, we're continuing to accommodate Beijing's aggression today. And that really risks Chinese overreach tomorrow and maybe miscalculation or war.
Well, you know, you mentioned miscalculation. Isn't it something we have diplomatic messaging like this between Janet Yellen and Beijing, the outreach that we see, a personal visit? While we're talking today about the Biden administration laying out billions of dollars to Taiwan Semiconductor so they can come here and build foundries in the United States, as we talk about banning TikTok if it's not spun off from ByteDance. Craig, how do you have all of these at once?
Really expensive proposition. You really have to think about, can we wage industrial policy well? I think at least on the TikTok front, you know, the clock is ticking on this TikTok bill, you know, despite passing overwhelmingly in the House. Senate leadership, particularly Senator Maria Cantwell, has not even scheduled a hearing, let alone a vote on the legislation. And in the meantime, TikTok's lobbying team, which is the largest of any Chinese company in Washington, is aggressively moving to kill this bill. I think you know, there is really, though, next to nothing from stopping a bold national security focused senator from attaching the TikTok bill to a must pass piece of legislation like the National Defense Authorization Act. That would absolutely, you know, ruffle some feathers here in D.C. But at the end of the day, I'm not sure senators can run or be perceived as being weak on China during an election year. And President Biden has already given them top cover by saying, I'll sign this thing the second it hits my desk.
Well, that's true. Are senators hearing the right pitch? You mentioned the lobbyists managed to snuff out this story for a good year in Washington. Somehow it came back. This gets a new breath of life in the House. Senators have been briefed by the White House. They've had classified security briefings on this, Craig. Are they hearing what they need to?
I think they are. No one that I'm aware of, no member of Congress has walked out of those intelligence briefings saying TikTok's not a threat. I think what they do sort of disagree on is whether this proposed legislation, which seeks a forced divestment, not a ban, a forced divestment of TikTok, is the way to go. And I think that there's some discussion about whether the bill needs to be expanded in terms of scope. And I think ultimately those efforts, a lot of them which are being championed by TikTok's lobbying team, are aimed at killing the bill, making it too big so that it fails. I think in this case, this is narrow, it's focused. It's been reviewed and drafted in partnership with the Department of Justice to ensure that it can withstand court challenge. And there certainly would be one. But at the end of the day, we're approaching a consequential election in a few months. The intelligence community has made clear that TikTok is the most important tool that the Chinese have to influence public opinion. It's time to ban it.
Craig Singleton, great to see you, Craig. Thank you for joining here on a Monday, Senior Director of the China Program at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Welcome to the Monday edition of Balance of Power here on Bloomberg Radio, on the satellite, and on YouTube, where you can join us now. Search Bloomberg Global News. You'll find our live feed. You can even back it up to hear the last interview if you wanted. A lot to talk about on Eclipse Day. I suspect that the nation's capital will come to a bit of a halt a couple of hours from now when the eclipse happens. We're going to speak a little later this hour with Julie Fine, who's not in Washington, but in the zone of totality. Has anyone made an album called that yet? Zone of Totality. Is there a song, Zone of Totality? Wouldn't that be forthcoming? We'll connect with Julie, where apparently people are flying from all over the country to be part of this. As we assemble our panel now on the day that Donald Trump makes his announcement on abortion. This has been teased since the beginning of last week. Didn't know if he'd go for 6 weeks, maybe 15. In the end, none of the above. Avoiding taking a stand on a national ban, pointing to the states. Here's Donald Trump in a video released a short time ago.
My view is now that we have abortion where everybody wanted it from a legal standpoint, the states will determine by vote or legislation or perhaps both, and whatever they decide must be the law of the land. In this case, the law of the state.
The state land. Donald Trump from earlier today. He promised an announcement on Truth Social last night, and there we have it. Our panel today, our signature panel, Rick Davis and Jeannie Shanzano back together again, Bloomberg Politics contributors. Jeannie, what do you think? If you're Joe Biden, this is good news, correct? You can keep running the ads you already made. You can make abortion the same issue that you have been framing it since the beginning of this campaign. What do you think?
Oh, I agree. This is what we call a non-announcement announcement. And he shouldn't have been forecasting that we should expect so much from his non-announcement announcement, because he heightened expectations and then, of course, let them drop. Because what he's saying is that nothing is going to change. It will still be up to the states. And just as we know electorally, the still being up to the states is what we've had since the Dobbs decision. And that has helped Democrats. So they've got to be celebrating in the campaign over there for Joe Biden, at least a little bit, knowing that they don't have to remake these commercials.
Well, and I say that facetiously. Then again, Rick, maybe you're going to tell me that this is the other way around. If he had reached for 6 or 15 or 12 weeks, that is, and talked about a national ban in any specific way, he would have handcuffed himself to a policy, right? What do you make of this announcement?
Just depends on who he was trying to make happy. I mean, if he was trying to play to the base and wanted to keep them excited about this issue, then he would have said that there are a lot of good proposals like Lindsey Graham's on a national bill. And he could have said that, you know, there are legitimate debates to be had around the time, and maybe even had suggested 15 weeks or something that has become a bit of a safe harbor, like Governor Youngkin tried to do in Virginia last election year. So there are a lot of options he could have taken. I think he took the one that was going to get him the most blowback from his base. And we see that from Lindsey Graham and from Mike Pence today, which is, hey, wait a minute. We never said this was just up to the states. And so now he's got exactly the opposite of, I think, what he really wanted, which was to be able to have it both ways. And at this stage, no Democrat's going to think this is a great idea to have Donald Trump protecting your abortion rights. And no Republican is going to be satisfied with his answer. So I'd say this is a bad campaign day.
Yeah, why even go there? To your point, Rick, Mike Pence just tweeted. This is a long tweet, by the way. I didn't know you could tweet this many characters. President Trump's retreat on the right to life is a slap in the face to the millions of pro-life Americans who voted for him in 2016 and 2020. Rick, he can't lose evangelicals over this, can he?
Yeah, he can. In fact, Susan B. Anthony released a similar announcement right after he posted his video. And they represent millions of right-to-life voters, and they are completely aghast at the president's decision. Look, I mean, he owns getting rid of Roe v. Wade. He might as well embrace it, take what he can out of it. It does show, I would say, if I'm reading the tea leaves, that they know the polls that, you know, Jeannie talks about all the time, which is abortion can get Democratic core voters and swing women in suburbs excited. And they're trying to put some air out of that tire. But I think they just added gasoline to the flames.
It's incredible. So interesting to think of the way this day is turning for these two candidates then, Jeannie. Joe Biden is in Madison, Wisconsin, in a college town talking about forgiving student loan debt. And it appears, based on the way this would all work or not work, that he can carry this for the duration of the campaign. So you've got abortion and student loan debt at the top of the stump speech here for Joe Biden. He's obviously got Israel and a number of other issues that are still dogging him. But when it comes to domestic policy, these are two that you might consider in his favor. How do you look at it?
Yeah, you might. I mean, certainly abortion. I think student loan is a bit tougher for Joe Biden. He's going to say it. He's going to run on it. Nobody, if indeed he's able to push this through with this second try, it's not going to be felt in time for the election, which may be a good thing if it's overturned. So, you know, I think that's more of a mixed bag on the campaign trail. And, you know, I would just say that a real problem for Donald Trump, to go back to that for a minute on the abortion issue, is here is somebody who has made his name saying, I am not a politician. I am not part of the, you know, the swamp that is Washington, D.C. And yet, what do we have here today? Somebody who's trying to play both ends against the middle. This is Donald Trump trying to be the pole, and he is not doing it very successfully. He's getting blowback from all sides. And that is something else the Biden campaign can use, because as much as we want to talk about positive things both campaigns can use to their advantage, this campaign is going to be about the negative, about the other guy. Nobody likes either one of these guys enough to vote for them, but they're voting against the other guy. And abortion and Donald Trump as a regular old politician is not a good thing for Donald Trump, and the campaign's going to use that.
Just quickly, Jeannie, you spend time with students all day. You're not hearing anything, any hopefulness about this announcement today. This is, you know, burned once when it comes to this issue. Show me what you got, Joe Biden. What are you hearing?
Yeah, we don't hear much about it because they've heard so much talk about it. They want to see action. Without that action, these young people are paying. And you know this well, Joe, because you have a son who will be going to college. It's expensive. And yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And I've got one in myself. And, you know, it's expensive. And these kids have no relief. It is a travesty in our system. But it's not one any president, forget about Joe Biden, can resolve on their own. It requires Congress. And we don't see a Congress that's going to act on this.
Rick, what do you think of the big fundraiser over the weekend? We talked about Radio City Music Hall for the three Democratic presidents. It was Biden, Obama, Clinton, a new record. Week goes by, Donald Trump tops that by a lot. $50.5 million, the biggest event we've seen of its kind at a billionaire's mansion in Palm Beach. Was this just about making a point, or does it actually help his campaign?
Oh, I think it absolutely helps his campaign. And part of what helps his campaign is he's making a point. And he needs the money. That's actually number one. And when you can write almost $900,000 checks into a political campaign and you've got a bunch of billionaire buddies, then you would expect to have this kind of an event. And kudos to the Trump folks for pulling it off. It's not easy. And they did it with a lot less negative attention than the Biden $25 million contributions in New York City. So, but they're going to need that cash. They're still lagging behind the Biden armada of the DNC, his PACs, and his campaign. So they're playing catch up, but they caught up a lot of ways this weekend.
Fascinating. Jeannie, is Joe Biden going to try to top him now? What can we do here in one weekend?
Oh, yeah, I think he's going to try. I don't know if he'll get there, but you've got to feel good if you're the Biden campaign. The fundraising aspect, unlike the polls, is in his favor still. He has a, you know, the small donors to go back to. Donald Trump's billionaire friends are, you know, now they are cut out of this thing, at least legally, unless they're going to go to the super PAC. So it's a problem for Donald Trump, not to mention he's got to pay off a lot more lawyers than Joe Biden does at this point.
They're going to be back next hour. Rick Davis and Jeannie Shanzano, our signature panel on Balance of Power. You couldn't have a Monday without them. I'm Joe Matthew on this Eclipse Day in Washington. We don't get the zone of totality here. We're off to the side, I guess, kind of like New York City is. We're going to get, what is it? We get like a two-thirds something. It'll get kind of dark. It'll feel like dusk here for a moment. No one's traveling here to to see the eclipse. People are traveling, though, to places like Texas to be a part of this. They're spending a bunch of money on airplanes to get there. They're spending money on Mexican food in Dallas when they arrive. That's where we find Julie Fine, Texas bureau chief for Bloomberg, in the middle of this all. Can't find a place to park or a place to eat, from what I understand. Julie, is this all worth it for you? What if you don't see the? What if the weather doesn't cooperate? This whole travel aspect confounds me.
Well, it's worth it for me because I'm here. But as for somebody
yeah, you don't have to travel.
Right. I don't have to go anywhere. I just have to walk outside, work, put on the glasses and look up. I think for somebody that's coming here, there will be, you will see something. You will absolutely see something. It may not be absolutely perfect, but it'll be dark. It'll be dusk for a little while. I think it's an event, and I think people are looking at it that way unless they're really specifically into the science of it. A lot of people made a weekend here in Dallas, which is a very easy thing to do. So yeah. I think for people that came, while it may not be perfect, it made for a nice couple of days. It certainly made a nice couple of days for Texas. You've got economists saying that this brought in more than $400 million for the state. There is apparently, really? According to the mayor, 400,000 people in the city of Dallas right now. So a lot of people headed to Texas this weekend.
Now, I don't know what, by the way, I'm asking about weather. I see you got, 74 degrees now. You're partly sunny today. You could still pull this off, right?
Yeah, I mean, we're watching the forecast as they come minute by minute. Sure, it's a little bit cloudy, but they're saying absolutely do not lose hope. And yes, it's definitely a little bit cloudy. It is not perfect conditions, but I mean, whether the weather forecasters and meteorologists are saying, you know, do not lose hope on this.
400,000, did you say, in town?
Yeah, the mayor estimated, I received an email yesterday, the mayor estimated 400,000 people in the Dallas area. Now, don't forget, we've got Fort Worth and we've got the surrounding suburbs around here. But look at a Super Bowl, Joe. I mean, a stadium holds 100,000 people, the largest stadium. So you see a bunch of people come in for that. That is not 400,000 people. So just to kind of show you how many people are around, that's a really good example.
So Texas already won, and the states in between. This thing's going to arc all the way up across. If you're with us on YouTube, we're showing you the zone of totality all the way up through Maine. Does it have a festive feel? I mean, you're nothing but sprawl down there in Dallas, right? Can you even tell that everyone's there?
Oh, you can tell everyone's here for sure. There are people
everywhere. So it's a mob
scene. It's a mob scene. Yeah, it's very, it's a mob scene. You can definitely sense that people are here. I mean, a lot of schools are closed. Some people are really treating this as a snow day. So, yeah, you can certainly feel that this is going on. I mean, I got in here to park this morning. I'm like, wow, this is the easiest day I've ever had parking. So, yes, people are definitely very into the eclipse.
All right, you got your glasses? Are they easy to find? I actually, you know, by the way, I'm big apologies to Craig Singleton. I probably made everyone feel bad because I didn't, you know, I was going to be too cool to wear glasses. I'm going to encourage all of our guests to put their eclipse glasses on.
Oh, absolutely wear glasses.
Julie, you've got them handy?
I was so worried there were going to be no glasses. I ordered for the office like 3 months ago. I took a poll. How many of you are going to be here? I ordered for the office.
Good.
You can get glasses pretty much all over the place. I was in Target yesterday. They still had glasses. There were tents on the street with people selling glasses. You can get glasses.
Look at that. Yeah, you can't find them anywhere around here. I even went to the library over the weekend. It had been a long time since I had tried that. Can we see the sun on YouTube? We have a sun cam. There's an eclipse cam here, Julie. I don't know if we can show it. There you go. I never thought I'd share a box with the sun before. Julie, thank you. Don't stare at the eclipse without your glasses. Our Texas bureau chief in the throes of activity on this eclipse day. I'm Joe Matthew without a pair of glasses, but Kaylee Lyons will join the conversation next. We've got a lot to talk about on Balance of Power, only here on Bloomberg.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
I'm Kaylee Lyons alongside Joe Matthew here in Washington, where we are not sadly in the path of totality today for the eclipse. Is Wisconsin in the path of totality? Because that's where
it's
President Biden
close.
Is going to spend his
good
afternoon.
Good point. I guess he'd have something to look at there, if not total. The Zone of Totality. I feel like there needs to be an album recorded. I think you'd make a lot of money right now. I've heard so much about this. We spoke with our own Julie Fine in the Zone of Totality to the south where, Kaylee, it's cloudy today.
That's a big bummer.
Yeah.
So I guess we'll get to see if President Biden experiences the eclipse or to a degree in Wisconsin. But of course, he's there with a very specific message today, Joe, and that is that he would like to provide more student loan relief to the Americans who are saddled with that debt.
And here you thought this was not happening. Remembering the Supreme Court shot down the first attempt to do this. Now, Kaylee, it's a plan B. We're talking about as many as 26 million Americans. The question is, will it work? That remains a question, and it could for the balance of this campaign. And that's where we start today with Jordan Fabian, Bloomberg White House reporter, is with us now for more on this. Jordan, it's good to see you. What makes this different than the first one? Is it the more strict criteria? How's the White House going about this?
It's still quite broad-based, Joe, but the White House has tried to make it more targeted in order to pass legal muster. So they've targeted groups like borrowers whose balances exceed their original principles, borrowers who might qualify for other federal programs but haven't yet enrolled. And so the hope is that by tailoring it a little more narrowly, they will be able to pass muster. But we'll have to see if the courts agree with that approach.
Yeah, and of course, we'll hear from the president about this afternoon. He's going to be speaking in Madison, Wisconsin, where, of course, the University of Wisconsin is. And that was also one of the areas in the Wisconsin primary that we just saw earlier this month in which he struggled with the uninstructed vote. A lot of young voters, as we have seen in college towns all across the Democratic primary states, are voicing protest over his policy surrounding Israel and the ongoing war in Gaza. Is this give them something so you can try to get them back, knowing they're upset with you over Israel? Try to make some progress on the student loan front?
Yeah, as you mentioned, Kaylee, these college towns are sort of ground zero for all of President Biden's problems. You mentioned the Israel-Gaza war. This student loan issue is a big issue for young voters, Gen Z voters, who he needs to show up in November. You know, I think we had polling showing them falling away from President Biden after they strongly supported him in 2020. He's going to need voters in these college towns like Madison, State College of Pennsylvania, to name a couple, to come out for him in November. And so he's starting today. You know, the risk is that he'll go to Madison, and I'm sure there'll be protesters there. But the White House is hoping that their message isn't drowned out and that this appeal breaks through to those voters.
Some impressive fundraising numbers, I'm sure you saw, Jordan, for March. $90 million for the Biden campaign and for the DNC. He ends the month with $192 million cash on hand, which is more than double what Donald Trump and the Republican Party, the RNC, have in their equivalent accounts here. It's interesting to me, the money game that we're talking about. Donald Trump's getting a lot of attention for setting a record over the weekend with a $50 million haul in one night. Doubling what Joe Biden managed when he was on stage with Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. How would you frame the money contest right now, if that's in fact what we should be paying attention to?
The $50 million haul is impressive, but it also illustrates how much ground President Trump has to make up against President Biden. Biden's war chest that is more than double of what Trump's is. And so why does this matter? Look ahead to, later this summer, going into the fall, when the election really starts to become the focus for people. Biden's going to have a lot more money at this point to open those offices in battleground states, to get people out knocking on doors, handing out materials, and also to flood the airwaves with advertisements. One of Biden's biggest problems is that he's done all these things in his first term, whether it's the Inflation Reduction Act, whether it's this action on student loans today, and he's not getting a lot of credit for it among voters. So the advertising could help that break through to people who haven't really been tuning in. So those are the ways that you could look for Biden to kind of outpace Trump. But money isn't everything. Trump was outraised by Hillary Clinton in 2016, and he went on to win. So while it's important, it is not the decisive factor.
All right, Jordan Fabian, who covers the White House for us here at Bloomberg, thank you so much for joining us. And of course, as Jordan there was talking about some of these college towns and the issues resonating there, including policy over Israel, we know, Joe, that the White House has been pushing and pushing more aggressively so perhaps Israel to do more in terms of humanitarian aid, protection of civilians. And that really has been the heart of the debate over an operation in Rafah, that city where over a million Palestinians have sought refuge. We just get a statement from Netanyahu about Rafah. Again, he says there is a date for that. We just don't know what the date is.
Yeah, it's really something, as you mentioned, they were pulling out of certain areas to regroup, and that did give us a sense that something might be about to happen here. The administration has been adamant about this. No invasion at all without a credible plan to evacuate civilians. I'm not sure that we see any reference to that here. It will happen, says Netanyahu. There is a date. We did hear from the White House over the weekend on this as well when it comes to our deteriorating relationship.
Yeah, this was something that Admiral John Kirby, who of course is a spokesman for the NSC, was asked about on ABC's This Week. And this is what he said.
We have been increasingly frustrated. And again, that was a core message that the president delivered to Prime Minister Netanyahu in their phone call this past week, that if they've got to do more, they've got to make changes. Now, the prime minister assured the president that he would do that. We've seen some announcements in those early hours. That's welcome. We got to see more. We've got to see it over time.
So for more, we're joined now by Carmel Arbit. She is Atlantic Council non-resident senior fellow for Middle East programs. Carmel, always great to have you with us here on Bloomberg Television and Radio. As we hear from Admiral Kirby there, the idea that they've got to see more, they think they will see it over time. How much are we seeing already? Not just in terms of the fact that there has now been another corridor open for humanitarian aid in Erez, for example. They have the military has taken action with those who were responsible for the World Central Kitchen strike that resulted in deaths of seven of those humanitarian aid workers. Are we seeing Israel actually come around to the U.S.'s way of thinking here? Or are these relatively small steps that don't actually fundamentally change too much in terms of their policy?
Yeah, thanks so much. I think we are at a fundamental change point in this war. It's not just that Israel has pulled out of Khan Yunis, it's that they have pulled the majority of their troops out of Gaza. As they prepare to move to the next phase of war, which will likely be more pinpointed attacks. So I think we are seeing a really significant shift here. Now, how that plays out is yet to be seen. I think on the one hand, you have Netanyahu speaking to domestic audiences, asserting over and over again that there will be an operation in Rafah, which many in Israel are now starting to doubt, while at the same time pulling out troops to prepare for what could be a breakthrough in ceasefire talks as part of Hamas's demands. So we're really at an inflection point in this war right now where we're seeing a shift in Israel's operation.
Well, should we doubt whether this invasion takes place now that we have this statement? Carmel, how do you read what Netanyahu is saying, only suggesting that there is a date?
I think the question is what that operation is going to look like. So 20 out of the 24 battalions of Hamas's military have been dismantled, and the four that remain are in Rafah. So the question for Israel is what they're going to do, how and when they are going to go into Rafah. Right now, as I had mentioned, the ceasefire talks are really very close, and there is a huge amount of international pressure, including from the White House, which is exerting pressure now in a way that it had not been throughout this war. We've seen a huge shift in U.S. public opinion and thinking about this war and in how the administration is approaching it. And with that, now we're starting to see a shift within the Israeli government as well.
Yeah, in part of the statement we got from Netanyahu, not just the suggestion that there is a date for an entry into Rafah, he also said he has gotten a report on those talks in Cairo. He says, we are working all the time for the achievement of our goals. First of all, the return of all of our hostages. And Carmel, as you talk about the international pressure on Netanyahu and the Israeli government right now, it's also worth noting there is domestic pressure as well. Once again, over the weekend, we saw thousands protesting, calling for a deal that would secure the release of those hostages. How should what's happening inside Israel factor into our thinking about Netanyahu's likely moves as we move forward?
It's very important. Ultimately, all politics are local. And so you see Netanyahu continually speaking to both sides, both to his far-right government who he's trying to show muscle to and that he will not cower to international pressure, and at the same time is responsive to the thousands of Israelis who are taking to the streets to demand the release of more than 130 hostages. Every day that passes, the number of hostages that are killed grows. It is now believed that about half of those hostages are still alive. And so every day the pressure mounts.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because there was a terrifying story in the Washington Post this morning about families, parents of two boys in this case, who they thought, two sons, were being held hostage, hoping for their release for the last 6 months, only to learn that they had died either during their captivity or as they were dragged into Gaza. Carmel, to what extent are families in Israel losing hope?
Yeah, there is a huge amount of pain in Israel right now, not just over the hostage situation, but that Netanyahu has yet to deliver on many of the fundamental promises he made about this war. That includes dismantling Hamas. And while he's made significant military gains, Hamas still remains in power in Gaza. The hostages have not been released. There is a huge amount of pain and suffering. More than 250 Israeli soldiers have been killed in this war in Gaza. And many Israelis feel that they are they're not winning. And so Netanyahu is under pressure to prove that that's not the case, while at the same time to try to retain his position of power, which is becoming increasingly challenged.
Well, as there is still, as you have rightly alluded to, a ongoing threat from Hamas, there are still battalions that have not been dismantled. There also, Carmel, though, might be more of a threat from Iran directly, not just from an Iranian proxy like Hamas. We have heard in recent days that Israel's military is prepared to respond to a scenario that could develop if Iran retaliates for the strike on the embassy in Damascus earlier this month. What could we see from Iran? Do you think we could actually see some form of retaliation from Iran directly rather than this being done through proxies as we have seen in the past?
Yeah, I think the stakes around Iranian retaliation right now are incredibly high for two reasons. One, the timing is going to matter a lot. Because the Israelis and Hamas are so close to a ceasefire agreement, anything that that Iran does right now could potentially derail that. So that's the first thing to keep an eye on. The second thing that we're looking at is whether or not Iran is going to escalate. There have been dozens upon dozens of attacks emanating from Hezbollah, also on U.S. assets across the region, and similarly, Israeli attacks on Iranian assets, including those that have increasingly targeted the IRGC and the Iranians directly. And we've seen that throughout the war. But up until this point, it's really been at a relatively low simmer. It's been kind of this medium heat, if you will. So the question now for Iran is whether or not they're going to increase that temperature. Most likely what we're going to see is some kind of attack on Israeli or American assets overseas. I think the scenario in which they would attack on Israeli soil remains pretty low, but would mark a significant escalation in this conflict.
So where does this actually play out then? Is it in Syria itself? Are we at sea, Carmel, or does that have yet to present itself?
It really has yet to present itself, and the Iranians have many options, and that includes everything from embassies or Israel's diplomatic presence overseas in countries as far-reaching as, you know, Latin America or Europe, where the Israelis have already put their staff on alert. We could also be looking at U.S. assets in the seas, and the U.S. has, of course, been working to tamp down on Houthi attacks, and has done so relatively successfully in recent months. So we could see really in any of these arenas, Iran really playing up its role and going after, again, either the U.S. or the Israelis directly.
Carmel, it's great to see you. Thanks for coming back to see us from the Atlantic Council. Carmel Arbit, on a day that we have learned, according to the Associated Press and now confirmed in a statement by Benjamin Netanyahu, Kaylee, that a date has been set for the invasion of Rafah. There's no sense, obviously, based on this conversation, when that will be or in what form that it will take.
No, all he says is that it will happen and that victory for Israel requires an entry into Rafah and the elimination of the remaining Hamas battalions there. So it becomes a question, Joe, of between now and whatever date ultimately is set for this operation, what can be done for the million plus civilians in Rafah? Can they be successfully moved, given aid, protected, as the U.S. would like to see?
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
As Janet Yellen wraps the big trip, her second to China in 9 months. And it's interesting, as each member of the administration kind of delivers their own message here, Kaylee, creating a composite that Beijing can react to. In this case, though, urging our competitor to rethink their economic strategy is an interesting way to go about it.
Yeah, well, her primary concern is that because China is dealing with kind of a multifaceted issue in their own economy, including the property sector, which has been weak for some period of time, they've been investing a lot in their industrial base, into manufacturing, and potentially creating, if you listen to the Treasury Secretary's concerns, more supply than the world is actually going to be able to absorb.
They're dumping
everything.
And that
was the message that she brought. The question is, was it heated? Will it be heated?
Well, that's true. Whether we're talking EVs or solar panels, this has a direct impact on our industries here. It's not lost on us that today the administration announcing billions for Taiwan Semiconductor to come here to start building foundries.
Yep, another fab they're planning in Arizona. All of that, of course, is part of a big push we have seen in semiconductors and chips in particular. But it all speaks to this idea that the U.S. is not trying to decouple from China. They are trying to diversify the supply chain, including bringing more here at home, while also normalizing this relationship, simultaneously trying to protect national security interests at the same time. It all is a very difficult picture that Janet Yellen and others in the administration face as they try to navigate this relationship. And we want to go now to someone who knows this relationship quite well. He's Lieutenant General Robert Walsh, Academy Securities Advisory Board member. He's also former commanding general of the Marine Corps Combat Development Command. General, great to have you here on Bloomberg Television and Radio. You helped develop the 2018 National Military Strategy and National Defense Strategy, in which China is defined as a strategic competitor. This is language that we hear a lot. What is your assessment right now of how the U.S. is treating China in this strategic competition? What exactly does that mean?
I think the relationship has certainly changed a lot from the days where we considered them a strategic partner. I think if you look at Secretary Yellen's visit and President Biden's call with President Xi Jinping last week, we've seen that the competition is very clear. And now I think the U.S. administration is really trying to thread a needle by maintaining relationships, trying to improve relationships with China, because they kind of dipped off for a while there, but try to improve those relationships, but still try to protect U.S. technology. And specifically, the Biden administration would like to be a leader in the green energy area in the globe. And they see China rapidly moving into that area. You mentioned EVs as one. And so that's an area is the Biden administration tries to create jobs in both the semiconductor industry and also the EV industry and the green energy. They see China's ability to over-manufacture and increase production, along with state-owned enterprise subsidies, be able to reduce prices and potentially flood the market and cause damage to the ability of the U.S. to manufacture here in the U.S.
Well, just to get back, General, to where Kaylee started here, let's go back to your view in 2018. That designation, strategic competitor, that you came up with in that piece of work has been repeated ever since by administrations, including this one. We've heard Joe Biden say more than once that China is someone we want to have a competition with and not a conflict. We've seen some interesting footwork around jargon here, from decoupling to I can't even remember what some of the other ones were at this point. Back where you were in 2018, if you looked at the relationship today, how would you have described it then?
I would describe it that China's continuing on the path that they've been on. How they've vocalized that or put that out from an information standpoint is different. And back then, when we really started to see them come online as what we considered a strategic competitor, they had just come out with Made in China 2025, which was a key blueprint or strategy that laid out how China wanted to dominate the globe in technology, listed in areas like AI, quantum computing, robotics, into semiconductors, those sort of things that we saw them saying that they're going to lead and lead the globe in. They kind of pulled that off the table and became kind of quiet for a while because it got a lot of adverse publicity around the globe that China was going to dominate and put others out of business. And since that time, we've seen them really march along that path. And now one of the things I think we're definitely seeing is the Biden administration seeing that. We talk about, you know, high tech capabilities, dual use capabilities such as semiconductors. We can look at how they dominate areas in rare earth minerals, some of the things that make batteries like those type of materials dominate those areas that not only can have a military impact on the U.S., but now we're seeing more of a competition on the economic side. And I think the real wake-up call is coming is the U.S. military and the Department of Defense has really studied China's military growth. What we're seeing is the Chinese Communist Party is really leading to much more towards economic dominance across the road through their Belt Road Initiative.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the military aspect of this relationship as well, because, of course, when Biden and Xi Jinping had their summit out in California in November, part of that was trying to normalize military-to-military communications, which had stopped for a period of time. And as Yellen was in China, we got news that the U.S. and China had resumed a dialogue basically aimed at preventing an inadvertent clash. How high, General, in your mind, is the risk of an accident, of some kind of miscalculation while we're still working on normalizing that communication? How much room for potential error, perhaps very significant error, is there?
No, I think it's a great, great point, Kaylee. They did begin those discussions. In fact, the first call came from President Biden to Xi in July 22. And like you mentioned at the APEC summit, they had another discussion. It's really, we have to keep the lines of communication open. Even as a competitor, which is completely different than we had with the Cold War with the Soviet Union, we always kept the lines of communication open so we don't have a misunderstanding of each other. Certainly in the South China Sea and the East China Sea, we see the Chinese military, the PLA, being very aggressive. Certainly around the Philippine Islands, we see that. Mm-hmm. And the risk of having a misjudgment, whether it's, you know, aircraft, ships at sea, there's always that danger. And one of the things I think that also concerns us is the Chinese military has been very aggressive in their actions. They have not been tested since 1979 in a war with Vietnam. And we just are concerned that the rhetoric that comes out of the Chinese military that is almost sometimes that they're almost itching for a fight, where the U.S. is trying to have clear lines of communication open so we don't run into a situation like that.
You mentioned China's plans for 2025, General. It was an Air Force General, Mike Minahan, who just about a year ago was out with a memo that some reporters got their hands on, urging his officers to prepare for a conflict with China as soon as 2025. Will he end up looking right?
You know, I think our perspective on that is, as you weigh it all, you know, as we look at the framework we kind of use, is we use as DIME, as diplomacy, information, military, and economic levers of power. Those are the things that kind of you can use as a national power to be able to try to coerce and compromise with a competitor. And I think in this case, if you really look at Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party, the one thing they want to do is stay in power. Staying in power means keeping their people happy. And I think economically, that's the most important thing for them right now, is to try to lead the globe economically. So though we see that they put out the rhetoric that by 2027, they'd be ready to take Taiwan militarily, we certainly have to be ready. And the Biden administration is doing everything they can to try to deter anything like that occurring. But at the end of the day, in the near term, though they've got the capability that continues to grow and in many ways outpace our own U.S. military, what we're seeing, though, is I think they want to lead more globally. And that's why I think you see this discussion between the Biden administration, between Janet Yellen with Commerce Secretary Raimondo, all going towards this economic area, because I think that's where we really see the Chinese trying to dominate. And they would do this strategically by starting with things like, you know, in Africa, in South America, in the Caribbean, those areas where they can get these rare earth minerals, things like cobalt and lithium, which can put them ahead in some of these high-tech areas to include some of the green energy capabilities.
He's a board member at Academy Securities. Retired Lieutenant General Robert Walsh, it's great to have you with us. General, thank you for your insights today. Thanks for listening to the Balance of Power podcast. Make sure to subscribe if you haven't already at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us live every weekday from Washington, D.C. at noontime Eastern at Bloomberg.com.